Today, it is our privilege to take you on a journey through one of the most respected and revered wine countries in the world. It has been a longtime goal of the Grape Encounters team to spend an extended period of time exploring the state of Oregon's breathtaking Willamette Valley. Known mostly for its world-class Pinots, the raves these Burgundian wines are getting is just a small part of the story. That's why your host, David Wilson, decided to pack his bags and devote an entire month of Grape Encounters to a full immersion, deep dive into the wines of Northwest Oregon.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
All right, this is one of those you probably wish you were me moments, because I am sitting on the patio now of Archery Summit, and we are in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. You cannot even believe how incredible this view is, how wonderful this place is, and how lucky the guy across the table from me is. It's Chris Mazepink, general manager and winemaker of Archery Summit. And Chris, one of the very select Pinots that makes the Grape Encounters cut. So I'm glad to be here, because I have that love-hate Pinot thing. Is that a bad thing?
I don't think so. It's a fickle varietal. We certainly have a love-hate relationship from bud break in the field to bottling in the winery. So no, I can relate to it.
Yeah. So you have one of the really great jobs here in this state. I mean, you've got the only wine cave, right?
It's true. Yeah, very fortunate. I came on about 5 years ago as GM winemaker and spent the entirety of my career in Oregon. I've loved the wines from Archery Summit for several decades and thrilled to be at the helm here now.
What is that like to have been a fan of the wines and then wind up being the general manager and winemaker, which, by the way, is a really weird combination, I think. We'll talk about that too.
Yeah, it's a unique left brain, right brain balance, I suppose. There's periods of the year where, you know, you probably lean more to the left or more to the right. Harvest is certainly a period of nothing but being winemaker. And then during the winter months, getting out and representing the winery and the broader market, doing dinners and tastings and things of that nature. So it's good. It keeps it stimulating, keeps it challenging, and I enjoy that. So it's a lot of fun.
I want to just back up to the beginning of your career, because you're a New York boy.
Yeah, so I grew up in Delaware and Maryland.
Wait, I just said New York. Well, you worked in New York,
yeah, I did.
Is what I should say. Yeah, okay.
But in Delaware and Maryland is where I was born and raised. Definitely not a wine household. I think it was Yingling and Dewar's on the Rocks back then.
Yeah.
But I went to college in New York, a small liberal arts school, and had the opportunity to work in a wine shop as a undergraduate student, and took a bottle home each night of wine and pulled the cork and got a chance to explore the wines of the world.
Did they just let you take a bottle every night?
I paid for it, literally and figuratively. You know, most pay periods, I did not get a check from the shop. Usually I had to write them a check.
Wait a second. That's education.
It is. I guess I could write that off.
You didn't see it that way, though,
I wasn't savvy enough to do that at the time. But no, look, it was a great exploration of the wines of the world because of that experience, as well as several other. Fast forward 20 years later, I find myself sitting here. So yeah, it was an interesting journey. I worked the fall semester in that wine shop when I was on campus. And then the spring semester of each year, I studied abroad all of my years in undergrad. And, you know, whether it was first world or third world, it seemed like all days ended the same. A bite to eat, something to drink, and just chatting with people about your day. So I was really enjoying the influence of food and drink on people's lives and culture. Combine that with graduation was looming closer and pondering that most basic question of life. If I could do anything with the rest of my days, what would I do? I decided to pursue one of my hobbies and see if I could make it into a profession.
You had three passions, you told me before we went on the air.
Yeah, somewhat of a spread out amongst different disciplines. Avid downhill skier, avid fly fisherman, and lover of wine, and really just kind of cycled through the three. If I was going to be a ski instructor, what would I do during the summer months? If I was going to be a fly fishing guide, what would I do during the winter months? Maybe I could have put something together with those two, but in the end, chose to go after wine as a profession and moved out to Oregon about 20 years ago to go to graduate school for fermentation science and viticulture at Oregon State University. And, you know, the industry was very different back then. There was less than 100 wineries in the state. Today, there's over 700.
Isn't that amazing?
A lot of growth.
So now you're sitting in what is arguably one of the, I don't know what, 2, 3, 4 best Pinot regions in the world.
Yeah, I would put it in that top 2 or 3. And, you know, I don't know that I would necessarily rate them 1, 2, 3. Or
it's different, you know.
Yeah, it's very different
animals.
What,
do you like New Zealand lamb or do you like lamb from, you know, the state?
Yeah.
You know, they're both good, grass-fed or grain-fed.
It's somewhat an interesting topic. You know, obviously Burgundy being the birthplace and they have a 500-year head start on us here in Oregon. Dundee Hills, I think, is an incredibly compelling place to grow and make Pinot Noir in Oregon in general.
And I just want to clarify, that's where we're sitting right now,
yeah.
Dundee Hills. And then we look down into the valley, right?
Yeah, so Dundee Hills is a sub-AVA of the Willamette Valley. And the Willamette Valley is a pretty large AVA that goes from Portland all the way down to Eugene. So it's over 100 miles long and over 40 miles wide in some spots. A really large AVA, and just in the last decade has been broken down into sub-AVAs. But it's interesting, you know, in talking about the top 1 or 2 or 3 regions in the world to grow and make Pinot Noir, I found that when I first started my career here in Oregon, we frequently compared ourselves to other regions. So we were comparing ourselves to Burgundy or to California, and that's how we talked about Oregon. I've found
a big mistake, right?
Well, you know, look, if you're just starting off, you try and emulate somewhere that's been successful, right? The benchmark standard. But what I found in the last 10 years, maybe 15 years here in Oregon, is that as opposed to comparing ourselves to Burgundy or California, we're now starting to compare ourselves to previous Oregon vintages. And that's a big fundamental shift in the way that we talk about ourselves. So instead of saying, you know, the 2015 vintage is more like something from Vosne Romanée or more like something from the Santa Cruz Mountains, we're starting to compare the 2015 vintage to previous Oregon vintages. And that's a really, really important fundamental shift in this place.
I could definitely see that. We're talking to Chris Mazepick. He's the general manager and winemaker, left brain, right brain. He's the big kahuna, let's just put it that way. Grand poobah, I suppose, here at Archery Summit.
Yeah, part of a bigger team. We've got folks in the vineyard that have been with us for 15 or 20 years. We've got people in the winery that have been here for over a decade on the production team. So I'm a part of something that has a lot of continuity and some deep roots, both in the farming side and on the wine production side.
So let's go back to this topic of, you know what, I hate the word terroir. Can we come up with an American word for the same? Oregon, you know, definitely has, I think, come to that place where it only cares about its own identity, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the amazing things that, you know, there are so many wines in the world. And to me anyway, I would want to distinguish myself in some way from everybody else.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, you start with great places, right? I mean, the key to great wine is having great vineyards. And that is more true with Pinot Noir, in my opinion, than any other varietal. Pinot Noir is all about the place that it was grown and produced. And secondarily, in my opinion, the people that were involved in making it and growing it. So finding the great vineyard sites and figuring out how to best unlock their full potential is the riddle. And Pinot Noir is a riddle.
Why the obsession in the world with Pinot? Why is that with so many other varietals out there? Why is it that there are those few Pinot and Cab, you know, Chardonnay,
yeah,
you know, a handful of others that get all of the attention or the bulk of the attention, let's say, and then the others seem to be more also run?
Yeah, I suppose it really just boils down to the personality type of those that choose to pursue it. You know, Pinot Noir is a varietal that excels on the edge of the envelope. I mean, you've really got to go to marginal climates. You've got to go to areas where you're going to struggle to get it ripe every year because that's where Pinot thrives. As much as, you know, the vineyard manager doesn't like to see it, Pinot loves it when there's a little bit of rain right before harvest. Pinot loves being in a climate that it just crosses the finish line of the race with enough energy to finish the race.
So wait a second, then maybe Pinot may be a sport.
Yeah, it's a marathon, and there's a lot of hills along the way.
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, you always hear this from Pinot winemakers, that it's incredibly hard to make, it's really finicky, Yeah. You know, there are so many different, I hate to use the word, clones out there, and terroirs out there, and factors that affect what you're going to have in a bottle of Pinot. There's no such thing as just a bottle of Pinot.
Yeah.
You know, why not take the easy way and make something else? Hold that thought right at the moment, because that's what I really want to talk about next. We're with Chris Mazepink. He's the general manager and winemaker at Archery Summit in the Willamette Valley. We are sitting on top of the Dundee Hills. The view is unbelievable. This is a normal day, right? With just the clouds in the sky?
It's a much needed day. This was a long, long winter.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to come back. I want to talk about wine as a beverage versus wine as a craft product, or maybe even perhaps wine as an art.
Sure.
When we return with Grape Encounters from Wine Country, Oregon. Be right back after this.
Your special edition of Grape Encounters will continue from Northwest Oregon in just a moment. Perhaps you should pour one of Oregon's world-class Pinots to get you into a perfect frame of mind.
I was too far from home. I gotta get back to Oregon. Too far to roam. Trying to get back to Oregon.
All right, this is one of those you probably wish you were me moments, because I am sitting on the patio now of Archery Summit, and we are in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. You cannot even believe how incredible this view is, how wonderful this place is, and how lucky the guy across the table from me is. It's Chris Mazepink, general manager and winemaker of Archery Summit. And Chris, one of the very select Pinots that makes the Grape Encounters cut. So I'm glad to be here, because I have that love-hate Pinot thing. Is that a bad thing?
I don't think so. It's a fickle varietal. We certainly have a love-hate relationship, from bud break in the field to bottling in the winery. So no, I can relate to it.
Yeah. So you have one of the really great jobs here in this state. I mean, you've got the only wine cave, right?
It's true. Yeah, very fortunate. I came on about 5 years ago as GM winemaker and spent the entirety of my career in Oregon. I've loved the wines from Archery Summit for several decades and thrilled to be at the helm here now.
What is that like to have been a fan of the wines and then wind up being the general manager and winemaker, which, by the way, is a really weird combination, I think? We'll talk about that too.
Yeah, it's a unique left brain, right brain balance, I suppose.
You had three passions, you told me before we went on the air.
Yeah, somewhat of a spread out amongst different disciplines. Avid downhill skier, avid fly fisherman, and lover of wine, and really just kind of cycled through the three. If I was going to be a ski instructor, what would I do during the summer months? If I was going to be a fly fishing guide, what would I do during the winter months? Maybe I could put something together with those two, but in the end chose to go after wine as a profession and moved out to Oregon about 20 years ago to go to graduate school for fermentation science and viticulture at Oregon State University. And, you know, the industry was very different back then. There was less than 100 wineries in the state. Today, there's over 700.
Isn't that amazing?
A lot of growth.
So now you're sitting in what is arguably one of the, I don't know what, two, three, four best Pinot regions in the world.
Yeah, I would put it in that top two or three. And, you know, I don't know that I would necessarily rate them one, two, three.
It's different, you know.
Yeah, it's very different
animals.
What,
do you like New Zealand lamb, or do you like lamb from, you know, the state?
Yeah.
You know, they're both good, grass-fed or grain-fed.
It's somewhat an interesting topic. You know, obviously Burgundy being the birthplace, and they have a 500-year head start on us here in Oregon. Dundee Hills, I think, is a incredibly compelling place to grow and make Pinot Noir in Oregon in general.
And I just want to clarify, that's where we're sitting right now, Dundee Hills. And then we look down into the valley, right?
Yeah, so Dundee Hills is a sub-AVA of the Willamette Valley. And the Willamette Valley is a pretty large AVA that goes from Portland all the way down to Eugene. So it's over 100 miles long and over 40 miles wide in some spots. A really large AVA, and just in the last decade has been broken down into sub-AVAs. But it's interesting, you know, in talking about the top one or two or three regions in the world to grow and make Pinot Noir. I found that when I first started my career here in Oregon, we frequently compared ourselves to other regions. So we were comparing ourselves to Burgundy or to California, and that's how we talked about Oregon. I've found
a big mistake, right?
Well, you know, look, if you're just starting off, you try and emulate somewhere that's been successful, right? The benchmark standard. But what I found in the last 10 years, maybe 15 years here in Oregon, is that as opposed to comparing ourselves to Burgundy or California, we're now starting to compare ourselves to previous Oregon vintages. And that's a big fundamental shift in the way that we talk about ourselves. So instead of saying, you know, the 2015 vintage is more like something from Vaughan Romane or more like something from the Santa Cruz Mountains, we're starting to compare the 2015 vintage to previous Oregon vintages. And that's a really, really important fundamental shift in this place.
I could definitely see that. We're talking to Chris Mazepick. He's the general manager and winemaker, left brain, right brain. He's the big kahuna, let's just put it that way. Grand poobah, I suppose, here at Archery Summit.
Yeah, part of a bigger team. We've got folks in the vineyard that have been with us for 15 or 20 years. We've got people in the winery that have been here for over a decade on the production team. So I'm a part of something that has a lot of continuity and some deep roots, both in the farming side and on the wine production side.
So let's go back to this topic of, you know what, I hate the word terroir. Can we come up with an American word for the same? Oregon, you know, definitely has, I think, come to that place where it only cares about its own identity, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the amazing things that, you know, there are so many wines in the world. And to me anyway, I would want to distinguish myself in some way from everybody else.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, you start with great places, right? I mean, the key to great wine is having great vineyards. And that is more true with Pinot Noir, in my opinion, than any other varietal. Pinot Noir is all about the place that it was grown and produced. And secondarily, in my opinion, the people that were involved in making it and growing it. So finding the great vineyard sites and figuring out how to best unlock their full potential is the riddle. And Pinot Noir is a riddle.
Why the obsession in the world with Pinot? Why is that with so many other varietals out there? Why is it that there are those few Pinot and Cab, you know, Chardonnay,
yeah,
you know, a handful of others that get all of the attention or the bulk of the attention, let's say, and then the others seem to be more also run?
Yeah, I suppose it really just boils down to the personality type of those that choose to pursue it. You know, Pinot Noir is a varietal that excels on the edge of the envelope. I mean, you've really got to go to marginal climates. You've got to go to areas where you're going to struggle to get it ripe every year, because that's where Pinot thrives. As much as, you know, the vineyard manager doesn't like to see it, Pinot loves it when there's a little bit of rain right before harvest. Pinot loves being in a climate that it just crosses the finish line of the race with enough energy to finish the race.
So wait a second, then maybe Pinot may be a sport.
Yeah, it's a marathon, and there's a lot of hills along the way.
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, you always hear this from Pinot winemakers, that it's incredibly hard to make. It's really finicky.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many different, I hate to use the word, clones out there,
yeah,
and terroirs out there, and factors that affect what you're going to have in a bottle of Pinot. There's no such thing as just a bottle of Pinot.
Yeah.
You know, why not take the easy way and make something else?
Yeah, look, there's certainly a path that I could have chosen, but the great challenges in life come with great reward, don't they? So, yeah, look, there's places in the world and varietals in the world that winemaking can be a bit more formulaic, but with all due respect, I mean, if that's what I'd wanted to do, I'd go make Pepsi or Coca-Cola as opposed to something as cerebral and emotional as Pinot Noir can be.
Hold that thought right at the moment, because that's what I really want to talk about next. We're with Chris Mazepick. He's the general manager and winemaker at Archery Summit in the Willamette Valley. We are sitting on top of the Dundee Hills. The view is unbelievable. This is a normal day, right? With just the clouds in the sky?
It's a much needed day. This was a long, long winter.
All right. Well, we're going to come back. I want to talk about wine as a beverage. versus wine as a craft product, or maybe even perhaps wine as an art.
Sure.
When we return with Grape Encounters from Wine Country, Oregon. Be right back after this.
This special Grape Encounters visit to the Willamette Valley will continue in a couple of minutes, so don't go anywhere. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and I am so happy now to be at Duck Pond Cellars, and we are with Trevor Shalanda, and you've got a lot of experience under your belt, but I think that you might be the ultimate kid in a candy store. So that's really the subject of today's Grape Encounters, is what would happen if you were a winemaker and somebody handed you the keys to a really big operation by Oregon standards and said, okay, go make wine. But I guess, Trevor, they also probably said you got to make money too, right? Welcome.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, David.
Man, it's nice to be here with you. And you've laid out some wines, which I have enjoyed, by the way, immensely.
Thank you.
The Duck Pond name is a bigger name around the country. It's probably going to be more recognizable than a lot of winemakers in the state of Oregon. Your output here is not huge by California standards, but by Oregon standards, it's pretty large. Talk to me about that, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, we're about to celebrate our 25th anniversary, actually, next year. So we've been around in the market quite a bit. We're about 60,000 cases total. And again, the good part about us is we've got basically we're a tale of two wineries. We've got our larger production, 55,000 cases of wholesale, and we've got our boutique wines. 5,000 cases of, approachable, really great stuff at the winery. So that's the good part.
But when you say 5,000 boutique cases, that's made up of a lot of small pieces, right? You were telling me before we came on the air that you're making all kinds of different things in different quantities, maybe some very small lot stuff. And plus and we're going to get into this in a second, but you've got some things to play with in the back that you inherited and now you're working with. So let's talk about you as the kid in the candy store, as I introduced this. You get this is probably a dream job, right?
Oh, absolutely. In so many ways. I mean, and that's the thing, is I do say 5,000 cases, that's split amongst 27 different wines.
Holy smoke!
So, I mean, our smallest lot that we're going to do this year is about 25 cases.
So what do you make 25 cases of?
We actually did a whole cluster trial, 100% whole cluster. And normally it'd be something that it would just be an experiment.
It's a Pinot.
Yeah, it's a Pinot Noir.
Yeah, okay.
We just put it in the back room and just blend it away after we did what we needed to. But I wanted to showcase that to our consumers who just want to try something different. I mean, then we start stepping up into slightly larger production of a skin contact Pinot Gris, things like that, where, I got to play around, and the Fries family has been so wonderful. They go ahead and say, go ahead, make whatever you want, just make money on it. I mean, that's the good part. So I got to play with a bunch of different things, a sparkling wine we're going to be making, all these little fun projects, and really delve into what we have on our 600 acres.
Okay, so I have in a glass over here, I'm going back and forth between two whites and two reds, but I have this sparkling here. There's a great story behind this. You made it, but you didn't. Explain what this is. But how long did it take to finish this wine?
Honestly, it took me a couple blending sessions.
No, how long did it take from start to finish?
Start to finish. So it started its journey in 1996.
Holy smoke.
This was actually one of those wonderful
21
things.
Years ago.
Yep.
Hey, it got lost.
Yeah, so Greg Fries, who was the original winemaker here and also one of the owners, he made it for his sister's wedding. He made about 500 cases. They disgorged some of it then.
Hold it. How big was the wedding?
Yeah.
500 cases for his sister's wedding. So let's say every person got a bottle. That's well over, 5,000 people at the wedding?
Yeah.
Was it a big wedding?
No.
Well, hence, apparently not, because the wine didn't make it to the wedding.
Correct.
What happened? Did she decide not to get married?
No, she's wonderfully married to Scott, but basically we had started disgorging it on demand, and so they disgorge little pieces at a time, and they do about 50 to 100 cases at a time. Well, that went until about 2007, when they, I don't know, either got disinterested or it just forgot about it. I mean, so when I came on board, I was planning on making a sparkling and reviving a program in 2016.
And that's okay. You can leave it undisgorged indefinitely, right?
Oh, absolutely. So okay. This was all under crown caps. And so I found it as I was walking around the winery, taking inventory and just seeing what's going on. I was like, oh, cool. We have tirage bins. They're pretty expensive. I didn't want to have to buy them.
Explain what that is to a listener that doesn't know what that is.
Yeah. So basically, once you make sparkling, it gets put down into these wooden boxes and they just sit there until you're ready to finish it. And so basically, I looked around and had these bins and I lifted up a piece of cardboard and underneath it was full.
So what have we here?
Yeah.
Oh, so then, my gosh.
Then I went to Greg and I asked, I said, hey, Greg, what's this? He's like, oh, yeah, we made some back in 1996. We made a little too much. And, you know, it's just been there. And I said, can I finish it? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. If you want to do it, go for it. And luckily, there's now a great custom facility that actually does that and will disgorge for us. And we disgorge.
Well, so you actually had somebody else do that.
Right.
And explain the process of disgorging, because a lot of people may not understand how that works.
Yeah. So sparkling wine is basically two fermentations. You've got the first fermentation that happens outside the bottle, and then you put it into a bottle with some yeast and some sugar. And yeast and sugar make all the happy things happen. Basically, the yeast take the sugar that you've added and then make bubbles out of it. But now you've got all these yeast cells in there. So if you just left it that, it would be cloudy. So disgorging is basically the process of getting those yeast cells out. And so basically what we'll do is we turn the bottle on its head and then just through a process called riddling, which is turning the bottles and getting the yeast to go down to the neck.
And then how long does it take before the yeast travels all the way down the neck? I know we're getting way off topic. But
no, it's fine. So the thing is, traditional hand riddling, so doing it by hand, where it's about a six-week process. And we actually use Giro pallets, which are a machine that basically do that. And it takes about 6 days.
Okay, good. Did you see, by the way, what happened while we were talking? And something happened off mic. I do want to mention this. Okay, I'm drinking the wine, right? And Aaron Bartels, who's been my escort from Southern Glazers, okay? So he's arranged this trip for me. He saw me pick up the glass. He immediately took his empty glass and thought I was going to pour my sparkling in this glass. And you know what I did? I chugged it right there on the air. I mean, you're not getting that. What are you doing?
I don't blame you.
Some people. Wow.
I know.
Oh, you're going to get a good tip at the end. Don't worry. All right. The tip is never take my wine. Okay. Anyway, so that's the story with that, but that is delicious. That's really good. How
fun.
Are there a lot of projects like that that you have here that you're still, you know, in the middle of working on?
Yeah, there's a couple more things back there. Again, the family, with the number of vineyards they have, there were just a couple of things that slipped through the cracks. So we've got two 15-year-old tawny ports that are sitting in the barrel, and I actually just did a splash rack on it, so just about
now,
the last
you said
thing.
Tawny port, but are you allowed to use the word port here at this facility?
So the cuteness...
What's the deal here?
The cuteness that we call it, and we actually use La Puerta. We needed something that sounded like it, so of course we use the Spanish word for door, but it's La Puerta.
And the TTB lets you do that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Those are the people who approve the labels. There's strict rules here. You can't call it port.
Exactly.
If it's not made in Portugal, well, in the Douro region of Portugal, I should say. Anyway, okay.
So again, so it's just been these little happy things that have been, you know, these gifts and wines that most people don't, you're not going to start a new program and wait 15 to 20 years. So, you know, to be a winemaker and have that, not only am I a kid in a candy store, I'm also eating other people's candy, if you will.
Well, there is a good metaphor. That is fantastic. Wow. So you actually came here from California. You know, it's really funny because I don't think that I have talked to a single winemaker on this odyssey, for the most part, that doesn't have roots in California. There's a lot of brethren here. Is there not?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually,
California is definitely boot camp, right, for anybody that wants to be a serious winemaker, for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of great winemakers in both areas, and I think there's a lot of techniques that we've pioneered in California that hadn't really made it to Oregon.
Yeah.
And I think that's been the biggest thing about getting some new blood up here. I generally appreciate everything that's been done in Oregon up to date, but actually there's three or four of my former interns that worked under me.
Is that right?
Actually are now up here.
So you have some connections here for sure.
Yeah.
What is it that, and I don't think I've asked a single winemaker this question on this trip, but I'll ask you, what is it about Oregon that's better than making wine in really, you know, the biggest producing, best known region of California, like Napa, Sonoma, or even the Central Coast? What's different?
In many ways, you just answered your own question. The good part is that bit of frontierism. Oregon, there aren't defined norms. There aren't the way you have to do it. And in a lot of ways, I mean, Napa, first thing anyone would ever say is Cabernet. That's what they do. And there's a certain style that is evoked by Napa Cabernet. Oregon Pinot Noir just in and of itself is different. And that's the beauty of it. I love the challenge. I like the inability to necessarily reproduce the same thing every year. It's just not possible. And there are glimmers of similarity. There's a beauty to it, and it's just fun. There's a youthful nature to Oregon. They figured out Pinot Noir was a good thing. Now it's time to figure out what else we can do up here. And I think there's that,
yeah, I think
that ability.
That also is the impression that I've been left with, is that for the person who doesn't like Pinot, the Willamette Valley doesn't hold a lot for you. You're going to be going and buying wines from California or some other place. And I shouldn't say that, because you do make other wines here, but Pinot definitely dominates. I think Pinot actually dominates here more than Cab dominates in Napa. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. Oh, in a lot of ways, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's strictly because Oregon kind of found out what worked and continued doing it. And there wasn't a lot of Pinot anywhere else of major note. So Oregon made their name, and they didn't really feel the need to explore too far beyond that. They became known for Pinot Noir. They made more Pinot Noir. It sold more Pinot Noir. But it's a very competitive marketplace now up here. And I think it's time to start branching out and finding other things that do remarkably well up here. And
right.
I know there'll be a list.
I want you to look me straight in the eye. You tell me whether you think Oregon makes the best Pinot in America.
Unequivocally, I think that the best Pinot Noir will come from Oregon.
Will come. Wow, that was a Trumpian answer there.
Well, I've only been here 1 year.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. You totally got me on that one. Okay, listen, we're going to take a quick break here. We're talking to Trevor Shalanda. He is the winemaker here at Duck Pond Cellars, and he is definitely one of the happiest people I have ever met, because he has the dream job and apparently is rapidly ensuring his job security here at Duck Pond. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this.
Your special edition of Grape Encounters will continue from Northwest Oregon in just a moment. Perhaps you should pour one of Oregon's world-class Pinots to get you into the perfect frame of mind.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and I am with somebody whose life is a bit like mine. He is a kid in a candy store. He gets to do some really, really awesome stuff. He has taken the reins at Duck Pond Cellars, which is a very well-known brand from Oregon, and you can get their wines all over the country. Trevor, you guys have national distribution, right? In most states?
We're in most states, not widely, mostly in the Pacific Northwest, and you know, we've got a few other markets that we hit pretty hard, but we're pretty much in places around the country, so almost everywhere.
Okay, so the answer to that is maybe, but maybe not. But then, yeah, you can find out very easily where wines are available if you're interested in something. But I think that it's going to be really interesting from now on, because I got a real sense that Trevor is going to be performing magic. And what makes me say that is you have been associated with some legendary wine. Wines, but I'm saying wine because you were involved with The Prisoner, which is probably the most successful, and we'll call it luxury brand out there in American history.
Yep.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
Tell me your background with that wine, because that's a name to be associated with. That project has been so massively successful. And when the company sold, or the brand sold, I should say, I think it was the largest dollar amount ever paid for a wine brand. Is that right?
It was at the time. That's correct. Actually, it was a great project to work with. Everybody who was involved in that, I was actually after the first sale. Now it's actually been sold again. But the first time, it was just a great crew. Learned a lot from them. It was in my role as the assistant director of winemaking at Bin to Bottle, my custom crush facility I worked at. And
see, that's surprising to me. And for those who don't know what custom crush means, it means that somebody else is actually doing the winemaking process, probably under the guidance of the person who, you know, is making the wine, but then they use somebody else's facility. About right?
Correct. It's a good way to, especially small startup companies. That's the amazing part, I think, that gets everybody, is that this is a very large production that is made in custom crush facilities. But it gives them the ability to be nimble, and it's a great process. Learned a lot from them. They're wonderful people. Everybody involved with that project is absolutely wonderful. And then the wines, truly, they built a wonderful wine around, you know, some of the best fruit in Napa Valley.
I think that's a very interesting point that you're making there. This was a big, is still, by the way, a huge brand, but it's not cheap. It's a luxury brand, right?
Yep.
And how do you make that much wine and keep the consistency and make it worth that price?
Yeah, I mean, and my answer to that is the grapes. honestly, they sourced the best grapes they could get. They weren't inexpensive. They made sure to get a quality and consistent supply and then truly turn it into something special.
How do you maintain the consistency when you're working with grapes that are coming from various places? And you're talking about a brand kind of like Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. You know, they make 10 billion cases of it or something like that. And it always tastes exactly right. And it's a good wine. And Prisoner was exactly the same. It was always consistent. How do you do that?
And I think this is the biggest lesson I learned from them, is that there is no recipe. They approached every vintage differently. It wasn't, we pick at a certain level of ripeness. We're not going for a particular alcohol. We're not trying to make it into a box. They went with, what is this vintage giving us? And it was amazing for something that...
But it was very consistent, though, from year to year, though.
And that's the amazing part.
All the same, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the
part. And yet it had vintages that, you know, was not a non-vintage wine, and the consistency was pretty much the same. There was a point in time where I felt that it had fallen off, especially when they got, like, hyper big, but the wine's delicious now. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that, but that's your training ground, and now you're coming to a facility where you get the opportunity to make a huge amount of wine, but it looks like your approach is that you're going to chop it up into smaller bites and make a lot of variety. And again, how many different wines are you making here right now?
So a total of 34.
Holy smoke. Good God.
And I think that's a little bit of my masochism. But the big part for me is, how do you learn about your vineyards? We're 100% estate grown. Even at our size, we own 600 acres. We grow everything. We do everything for ourselves. We actually have our own grafting facility. So if we replant a vineyard, we make the plants. And so we do everything, start to finish.
That's, it's playing truly, God a little bit there.
It gives us the ability to do what we want to do. And it's amazing. I come from a plant science background. I'm a research scientist. So my brain goes, how do I learn the best about it? And truly, it's chopping it up and then reassembling it. And it's a beauty that we can do that here. But it's the good part.
Exactly.
For a winery this size, you don't expect that. You just don't. And that's something that brought me here, to add on to the list of why I came to Oregon. That's why it's such a wonderful fit here. It's an amazing place. And the family's wonderful. And everything that I get to do is just not given to many winemakers.
So how involved is the family? Is it arm's length, or are they here every day, or what's the story?
So basically, our director of vineyard operations / president / winemaker for our sister brand is Greg Fries.
Okay, all right.
So he's very involved. Lisa, his sister, is the head of direct consumer. And basically, Doug, the patriarch, he is technically retired, but he's in the vineyards 5 days a week. I don't think we could chase him out. He absolutely loves it. He loves tinkering on the tractors and getting stuff done. His wife, Joanne, is also support for the winery on operations side.
Did you get the bosses riding around on a tractor in the vineyard?
The iconic image I have for Doug is him coming out of a machine harvester at 6 a.m. in the morning after picking, grinning ear to ear. It's what he loves. He's a farmer first and absolutely loves doing it.
All right. So we got just a minute or two left here, but tell me where Duck Pond is going to be, let's just say, like 3 years from now.
Yeah.
Is 3 years enough? You can do a lot of damage in 3 years. All right, let's make it five.
Five is a good one, because that's when we'll actually start getting some fruit on of new plantings. Hypothetically, I think Duck Pond, I'd like it to be a playground where we do a lot of different things, but do a lot of things really well. We've got to focus on making sure that we make our wines accessible to a large set of people. We have our large wholesale production, which, again, will continue to grow, and we'll continue to get it into more households around the country. We will get national distribution eventually and make sure that it's approachable. There's a revitalization that's happening. We're starting to replant vineyards and truly create some special things beyond what Oregon's known for, beyond just Pinot Noir.
And that's what I wonder about, because that's the one thing that has really stuck in my head, is just how Pinot-centric, especially the Willamette Valley, is. It's what, 70% Pinot? Is that about right?
You're probably pretty right there in Willamette Valley.
You talked about revitalization. Do you think that there are parts of the brand that had gotten a little bit tired, truthfully?
I think the big thing is innovation, and I think moving forward. I think we've got a great set of wines that we've made for a long time. Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay out in the wholesale market, and they do really well, and they're wonderful wines. I just see a reimagining, if you will, a reinvigoration of some of those products. Over-delivering. We've always done that, I believe. We're putting expensive fruit into inexpensive bottles.
Well, all right. It's been fun being here with you. You really appear to me to be somebody who's got the happiest job on earth right now.
Oh, definitely.
All right. Well, listen, hey, that's going to do it for Grape Encounters today. In fact, that is going to do it for our Oregon Odyssey. Thank you so much. And if people want more information about Duck Pond Cellars, it's duckpondcellars.com.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Yep.
All right. That will do it for Grape Encounters. We will see you back here next week in this very same time slot when we have our next Grape Encounters adventure.